personal, Jesus. Someone to hear your prayers, someone who cares. Your own personal, Jesus. Someone to hear your prayers, someone who's there.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
And I'm Don, political science philosopher.
I'm Rob, cognitive psychologist and annual Bigfoot hunter.
Bigfoot hunter, eh?
Yes, actually this weekend I was in Harrison Hot Springs, one of the big Bigfoot sighting locations of Canada.
And did you see Bigfoot?
No. Although I might have.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. You never know who was wearing that suit. So,
yeah. No, every Thursday they actually have a Bigfoot researcher there. I put Bigfoot researcher in loose quotes there, talking at the tourism office.
Well, why don't we go on to This Week in Science. So what's going on, Rob?
So a couple of stories have come up this week. One that was kind of interesting. There's a couple of different theories of how life actually arose on Earth. There is, you know, creationism and one that's...
Creationism isn't a theory.
It's a statement of
religious
fact.
Belief.
Yeah. The other one is that's quite popular among the biological sciences right now is the RNA world hypothesis, where in prehistoric Earth, conditions were such that it allowed amino acids to form strands of RNA, which then could self-replicate, turn into DNA, and we're off to the races. But one other such theory was not that amino acids formed on Earth, but that they came here from somewhere else, the panspermia theory. Panspermia also has the theory that, you know, life came fully formed from somewhere else or cells or something like that. But the sort of more reasonable one is that the building blocks of life came from somewhere else.
You're not talking about the X-Files, where we're actually an experiment from some alien race that's trying to figure out what the meaning of life is.
No, or even that that famous flop mission to Mars, where the aliens seeded us from Mars. But actually, this amino acid panspermia theory has gained some credence recently, as scientists have discovered an amino acid glycine in the samples taken from the comet Wild 2 in 2004 by the space probe Stardust. It parachuted the samples down to Earth in 2006, and they actually found trace amounts of glycine then, but they weren't sure whether it was a contaminated sample from Earth or what actually there was glycine in the comet. So now, 2 years, 3 years later, they've finally checked it out, and it indeed was glycine on this comet that travels all over the solar system.
I thought the Stardust one, wasn't that the one that crash-landed, though? The parachute didn't deploy or something, and they were worried they might not be able to get the samples out of it.
But I think there was something like that, but apparently it all checks out.
So, but the panspermia, but that doesn't really answer the question, does it? I mean, what is the real value of having panspermia, saying it evolved somewhere else? Well, sure, but that still doesn't tell you how it evolved.
Well, the idea that I sort of had about this was that When we're looking with the theory that amino acids formed RNA world only on Earth, then we're looking only at the conditions of prehistoric Earth. Now we have evidence that amino acids can come from elsewhere. So we have a whole lot of new situations to look at for the formation of amino acids, actually opening up the field of amino acids arising out of no intelligent process much more widely than perhaps it was before.
So maybe this will open some doors, and when we look for building blocks of life on other planets, moons, asteroids, wherever.
Exactly. Another study, it was a kind of a fun statistical study. There's this sort of famous modern urban legend that most of the bills, Jackson's, Hamilton's, whatever, in the United States have traces of cocaine in them from the rich and elite snorting cocaine through rolled up dollar bills, stuff like that.
All our currency is high, you're saying.
Well, researchers looked at 234 banknotes from 17 cities across the U.S. and found that 90% had small traces of cocaine. Bills from larger cities such as Baltimore, Boston, and Detroit were much more likely to have cocaine, lending perhaps some credence to this idea that rich people snort cocaine through. No, actually, they suspect that it spreads through bank machines because one bill has cocaine on it, it gets some lodged in the rollers of the machine, it spreads it to all the other ones in trace amounts, and there you go. 90% of your bills have cocaine in them.
You just know there's someone somewhere in the back room, somewhere in the United States, sitting there saying, so you're telling me, if I get all this money and I ground it down, I can get cocaine out of it? Wow, I can make millions off of that.
Luckily, grinding down money is also a felony.
Well, there you go. Well, Rob, tell us another interesting news story about a person who took some interesting new medication.
Alternative medical cure, I hear.
Oh, yes. This was in the Vancouver Sun just a couple of days ago. And it's a piece about a patient that had multiple sclerosis. And the headline is, multiple sclerosis patient credits orthomolecular medicine for ending painful attacks. And this is August 17th, just very recently. And it's about this guy, Peter Leeds, who suffered from multiple sclerosis.
What kind of multiple sclerosis?
Let's see.
Okay, I'm Josh. It's referred to as benign, although there's a recessive resurgent MS. It's a subtype of MS.
I don't know if his life was threatened by this, right?
Well, no, but it's one of those things.
It's one of those quality of life things. Yeah. It's excruciating pain,
but you only
problems
get the pain
moving.
Anywhere from maybe once a month to once a year to even longer. Like it's not a thing you live with, and usually in between, you make a near complete or full recovery of any of the effects.
Yeah.
So we're not talking MS. We're talking about a very specific subtype of MS.
This is there's a quote from here. Symptoms of begin to appear over a few hours or days, last for a day or a month. Between attacks, the body can recover almost completely. So it's the sort of thing where you have absolutely no idea when it's going to happen, how long it takes between attacks. And there is no known cure for it, but there are treatments for quality of life, again, reducing pain.
With this case, he got better. It must have been some really powerful science-based medicine he took then, wasn't it?
Well, the article says here that on the advice of a friend, Leeds traveled to Victoria to meet with Dr. Abram Hoffer, an orthomolecular practitioner who died in May. Hoffer was a Canadian psychiatrist, best known for treating psychological disorders through orthomolecular medicine.
What's
a science-based approach to healing and preventing disease?
What is ortho-based molecular medicine?
Now, I actually looked this up, and basically, orthomolecular medicine is better known by another name, megavitamin therapy. This is something that's been around since the 70s, has been panned completely by the scientific community. And basically, what it is taking the approach of nutrition as a treatment for disease. And the idea is that orthomolecular practitioners come up with a strict regimen of diet and nutritional supplements and vitamin supplements for the patient that are supposed to be specifically cued to their physiology that will treat whatever disease they have. And it was actually coined by the Nobel laureate Linus Pauling, and he theorized that substances which are normally present in the human body are necessarily good and therefore can be used in high doses to treat diseases.
Hmm.
Unfortunately, there is little to no evidence for this claim. And in fact, most of the studies that that I found on this, on sites like sciencebasedmedicine.org, found that some of the regimens, some high doses of vitamins, for example, can actually be very harmful to your body. And for example, if you're a smoker, high doses of beta carotene can be extremely dangerous to your health. And, you know, what's to say that an orthomolecular practitioner isn't going to prescribe the wrong regimen or a regimen that he doesn't know is dangerous to someone?
I know in my research, I noticed one of the things that they had said is that one of the problems of modern society is we don't get enough nutrients because of all the processed food, and that in primitive cultures, they never suffered from any of these diseases. Therefore, we should eat like the primitives did and make sure we get all these mega doses of natural-type substances.
Well, that's a good point there, Don. Why don't we take this into a segue into one of our emails? Maybe, Don, you could address this email.
Sure. It comes from one of our listeners, Louise, who is writing in response to the bit we did on organics. She comes up with a few interesting things, and I think they're valid things, and I think we should deal with them. One, she says, my query is that if I had an allergy to seafood and I ate a tomato that was genetically modified to have a gene from fish, would such an altered tomato cause an allergic reaction if I was allergic to seafood, right? Well, that's kind of
a reasonable question.
Yeah. Now, I did a little research on this, and one, there's never been a case like that occurred. Now, of course, that doesn't mean it can't occur, because again, when you start gene swapping, if it happens to produce the right protein, and it's the protein that actually causes an allergic reaction, but it doesn't really change the fact that if something out there starts causing allergic reactions, people start complaining about it, products get withdrawn from the market. So even if it did cause that,
there's recalls of food all the time for being in, you know, causing reactions, being contaminated with salmonella or whatever. I mean, recently there was that whole peanut butter fiasco in the States with salmonella.
Exactly. She also goes on to have another thing that that mass produced foods or corporate farming laces foods with chemicals, that insecticides, pesticides, and herbicides get infiltrated into the food. Now, again, most research shows that if this does occur, it's in a very limited sense.
I don't think there's ever been a documented case of someone getting ill from the pesticides leached into food.
No, although apparently it is a growing concern in third world countries for the farm workers.
Yes,
who quite often will suffer from using these things.
Yeah, from being constantly exposed to the pesticides through using them.
But it's also important to note that organic food suffers from this problem as well. They do get pesticides, organic pesticides,
yes,
but they do get them as well.
I was actually listening to a podcast recently, and they were mentioning about how hard it is for wine companies to get the organic label, because one of the things is they have to use an old-style organic pesticide or fungicide. But if they use that, they have to use like five times as much of it in order to get the same effect of a new modern one. So they just don't go to it. So is there a thing there? Yes, but I think you get more chemicals coming off your carpet. So in the level of degrees, I think it's minor. Now, another thing she mentioned, I think this is the most prevalent one, is labeling of genetically modified foods.
Yes.
Now, I think labeling is a good thing when it's relevant. So if you have corn oil that's made with genetically modified corn, sure, say it's GM corn. If you have a cow that ate genetically modified corn, I think you have to prove that the genetically modified corn somehow changed the cow. Ultimately,
I seem to recall, I'm not sure if this is true, so someone should check this, but I think the new organic labeling laws that Canada passed recently involves labeling genetically modified foods.
I think ultimately,
or rather genetically engineered.
Ultimately, she has the last line. She says, so even if organic foods are not perfect, given the evil corporate empire, which I believe it is evil and an empire, that exploits fears and beliefs that that organic food is a better alternative to corporate farming.
Definitely, it does. You know, farm locally, eat you know, sustainable food. We're totally in agreement with you. Thanks for writing in, Louise.
Okay, well, let's go to a commercial break, and we'll be back with a debate on race.
I swear to God, I'm not wearing just my underwear right now. This is Beth.
Hi, this is Beth Ditto from The Gossip, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. No, yeah, this is the best thing in the world. You guys are going to be blown away.
Welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. We're now going to be talking about race and genetics and the skepticism that goes along with it. We're also joined by Elon, all the way from Ottawa. So Elon, take it away.
Hi, everyone. Yeah, I'm back in Ottawa, but I'm happy to be able to still be on the show. Thanks for letting me come back. So I thought for this segment, we could talk about sort of race and the way we think about race, what the science has to say about different races. I'm not talking about a race that's going to be coming up in the Vancouver 2010 Olympics, but that was a Don joke. But we're talking about race, blacks, or Chinese people, or there it is. So we'll see, hopefully not offend anyone with this conversation, but I think it should be interesting. So I wanted to start off, there's three sort of subtopics, and I should mention that this whole conversation is motivated from my reading of The Ancestor's Tale by Richard Dawkins, which is a really great book where he sort of talks about all of the ancestors of the human species. But yeah, he did one section we called The Grasshopper's Tale. But okay, let's get on with it. So the first point that I wanted to make is that it's interesting that race is actually not really a clearly defined word. Unlike the word species, scientists have come up with a definition for species, which is basically two animals belong to the same species if they can interbreed. And that's basically, you know, it's a very simple definition, and people could maybe debate whether or not that's a good definition, but that happens to be the working definition that people are using right now. So humans are interesting because we could all interbreed with each other, and we could produce a continuous spectrum of what we could call maybe interraces. But so we're all certainly the same species, but still we use this racial language.
Wouldn't it be more accurate maybe to say, instead of race is equivalent to a species, race is equivalent to subspecies? For example, we have many subspecies of dogs or pigeons. Now, they all can interbreed, but at the same time, we take note that there are both genetic and more inappropriately, perhaps, morphological differences between them.
Right, exactly. So I guess that could be a good example, because, yeah, just like the different dog species can. And the neat thing is when we breed different dog subspecies, I guess, as you'll say, together, we get sort of neat concoctions, if you will, of dogs that look like in between one and in between the other. And we won't say, for example, if a dog of type A breeds with a dog of type B, we don't then just say that the new one is a dog of type A. You know, we say it's some sort of combination between, which is not really actually what happens with humans. So if you think of an example, let's say of black people, like let's say there's a black person who mates with a white person, or let's say even it's a black person whose parents had been one black and one white. So then we're talking maybe someone who's like, let's say 1/4 black mates with someone white, so then their child would be 1/8 black. But in our society, we'll call that child black, even though they may draw less than 1/8 of their ancestry from Africa, and they probably will have a very light skin color, but still we tend to sort of discretize and say you're either black or you're white, when really there's a whole range. Just the fact that all of the human species can interbreed with each other means we have pretty much every combination of every race, but yet we still use the language of you're either one race or another race.
Well, that has historic implications as well. In the past, there have been efforts to try to codify what race someone is by their ancestry of their parents, most notably in the United States during the Civil Rights Movement.
Right, exactly. So Richard Dawkins used the term that trying to codify people's races like that is, you'd be sort of, in trying to do so, you'd be smothered by the absurdity of the attempt. And maybe that's strong language, but basically what he's saying is we don't live in this discrete world, we live in a continuous world. And so just by trying to define someone's race by making this arbitrary rule of if you only have one ancestor really doesn't make sense when you think of actually the gene flow. And, you know, if there is a certain gene that we wanted to say defines a certain race, that's going to be completely smothered up by, you know, all of the subsequent generations.
That, though, I think is one of the problems that I tend to have with this debate in itself, is we're really comparing two different things. We have the genetic differentiations, which I think you have to accept if you believe in evolution, versus cultural differentiations, which I think quite often are specious and almost always have been used as a form of denigration. From an evolutionary standpoint, you can't debate the fact that in certain latitudes, people tend to be of certain colors. Now, whether that has to do with the fact that it's vitamin D absorption or something, those are interesting topics to investigate. I think it becomes very specious when you sit there and say, well, those differences lead to social or cultural differences, as in we are somehow better than or smarter than X, Y, or Z. I think the differentiations genetically are too small for that, but I think you're confusing the two if you say that there are no differences, that we're all one big happy tan family.
I think what you'll find, though, is you will see more difference within a group than you will between one group and another. So, for instance, you'll see more genetic diversity within a group, say, Western European, and you will see less difference between Western Europeans and Australian Aborigines, as opposed to seeing a greater difference between these two groups.
I have to, and I think everyone who deals with this topic has to make clear that although I think that there can be genetic differences and commonalities, that those are limited to genes and not to cultures or to society.
But Don, when you say there is differences, do you think there are you talking about differences of like of the superficial nature, or are you talking about differences in
terms of our
evolutionary psychology, sort of the way we've like evolved to think as humans?
Actually, so to begin with, no. I think as far as evolution working on our brains, or even to a large degree on our physical bodies, being able to run away from a predator is no different in Scandinavia than it would be in Australia. Being able to solve a problem or being able to use tools, I think, is the same in Japan as it would be in South America. I think those differences, there are no real differences there. But something like, for example, sickle cell anemia, which is a genetic characteristic disease, perhaps, that affects people who live in malaria countries. In fact, it's pretty much limited to Africa because that's where the genetic abnormality came up. Now, sickle cell anemia is a genetic difference. It gives those people who suffer from it a certain degree of immunity from malaria, which gives them an evolutionary advantage, which is why it's quite prevalent in areas where malaria is prevalent. Now, I think if we sat there and we say, well, you know, differences between genetic differences between cultures, between races, subspecies of humans, maybe is a better way to put it, doesn't exist, squelches our research into that.
Right. And so much of that is depending on environmental factors. I mean, the reason that we have variation is because certain groups of people have been isolated by physical or geographical features, whether they're on an island or they're blocked by big mountains or something, so that you have natural evolution taking place where you have small, very insignificant things happening, like the sickle cell anemia thing, or skin color, or facial features type thing. It's not really a species thing where you might have like a good definition would be there's different kinds of like species of whale, for instance, where they have radically different bone structure or radically different organic buildup in their bodies.
Again, why has that happened? If you believe in evolution, there must be a reason to it. There has to be some force that drove.
Well, yeah, I think that's what
that
Ethan
difference.
Was saying. Where when
well,
Ethan was talking about
careful about using the word force driving evolution. Evolution takes what it gets, right? Like,
so actually, this actually helps us segue really well into the third point that I wanted to talk about, because you were saying, Ethan, about how the way that sort of evolution tends to work is you have like all members of a certain species, and then they sort of separate because there ends up being some sort of like barrier, such as a mountain range or a river, and so now they're isolated, and then they end up, you know, forging into their own separate species, and that's sort of like how our evolutionary history has pretty much worked. So it's interesting when you think of humans, we don't actually now have these barriers, right? Like we can't. It's kind of hard to think of a way that we would sort of evolve into a sub actual species. Like we don't have these idea of like a mountain range. We could just take a plane, right? Or any human could sort of get to any other human and mate with them if they really wanted to. But Richard Dawkins made an interesting point in The Ancestor's Tale, and this really gets to the point of this grasshopper's tale, which I could tell you, which was that we sort of have come up with our own barriers now that can serve to act as a metaphorical mountain range or river. And these barriers come in terms of our, like, maybe our languages or different religions or social customs. Like, let's say if you're a religious Hasidic Jew, you're not going to mate with anyone who isn't also a religious Hasidic Jew. So sort of your culture, your religion is sort of becoming an artificial barrier, which is separate you from, you know, being able to mate with the rest of the species.
We're substituting physical barriers with cultural barriers.
Theoretically, if these cultural barriers held and no one from a certain group were to ever mate with anyone outside of their group, then in millions and billions of years, evolutionary time, we could actually speciate.
Would it? I think
speciation... To be at a point where they can't breed with any other human?
Well, again, depending on... Well, okay. So we're quibbling here. So I think it could happen sooner if you believe in punctuated equilibrium, which is not a creationist thing. It's an evolutionary... I wish I could remember his name, who thought of it.
The scientists I believe Don is trying to think of are Niles Eldridge and Stephen Jay Gould, who, among others, came up with the theory of punctuated equilibrium, which basically just states that evolution does happen, but it can happen very quickly over brief periods of time, given the right circumstances.
Well, and again, you mentioned, too, the fact that this is literally artificial speciation in the sense that man-made, genetically modified humans, if we can... mix our metaphors here.
So actually, I can tell you that, I guess to maybe round up this whole discussion, is the reason why this chapter in the Ancestor's Tale is called The Grasshopper's Tale, is there is sort of, according to the definition, actually, we were not being fully honest before, the definition of a species is that if the two animals can interbreed under natural conditions. So there is two different species of grasshopper that actually can interbreed, and under lab conditions, if you force one to breed from one species to breed with another one of the other species, they will interbreed and make a new, you know, and make a viable offspring that's fertile. But the difference is one grasshopper of one species has a certain mating song, and the other one of the other species has a different mating song, and grasshoppers under normal conditions only mate with the other grasshoppers that have the same mating song as them. So in this case, the scientists have actually classified these two species of grasshopper as different species, even though they can mate. So in that way, you know, not obviously to say that like different human races should be considered different species, but it is kind of interesting that maybe under natural conditions, do two people who speak a certain language, or is there some language, let's say, that people would only mate with people who spoke their language? That would be a good analogy to this grasshopper.
Now you've confused me. If you can interbreed, then you can't be a species, right? So these two grasshoppers, they can produce fertile offspring. Therefore, by your definition, they have to be the same species, even though they may choose for, and I'm going to use stretch the analogy here, for cultural reasons, may not desire to interbreed. Biologically, there is no limitation. So in the same sense that people who happen to be from Latin America could breed with anyone else, but if they choose not to, does that suddenly make them a new species of human?
Well, I guess that some sort of makes it a hairy thing in the beginning, because again, there's not like a rule. This is just a working definition that scientists have come up with in order to aid them with their research and to sort of make their claims more clear. And at some point, they decided on this definition that if two animals will breed under natural conditions, which isn't what I mentioned before, because I guess I was saving it for here, big surprise. But that's the working definition, according to at least what Richard Dawkins was saying in The Ancestor's Tale, is that seems to be the working definition that scientists are using. And I'm sure it's a controversy, and I'm sure there's people on different sides of the fence of what they should define as a species. But that's apparently the accepted sort of terminology that's used now, is that these grasshoppers are actually considered to be different species because they never mate under natural conditions. They only can mate under artificial conditions, even though they can produce fertile offspring.
I'd be curious to know what our listeners think about that.
I'd also be interested to know what, if we have any listeners or anyone that knows about sort of biology and this whole concept of speciation. Like, we sort of all have a colloquial idea of what species mean, and then I read The Ancestor's Tale, and so now I have this new idea, but I'd love to know what sort of people actually in the field are, you know, what they think of what I've been saying. Maybe they'll call me on all of my BS or something.
Well, I'm sure it's not BS.
Well, I guess it's Richard Dawkins' BS if it's my BS. But he seems to be a pretty reputable biologist from what I've heard.
Yeah, he's pretty famous.
But anyways, I just read that chapter, and I thought that all this stuff about race is just really interesting, and I thought that it would be a fun topic for the show. And it would be great to hear what other people think. Ethan, what's the email address? I've been away. I don't remember.
Well, I'll remind you then. It's radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
Really? Okay, let me send a test email. Okay. Or maybe I can do that off the air. Anyways, thanks for having me back, guys.
All right, well,
it's been fun.
Ilana, just whenever you got a great idea, let us know, and we'll be glad to have you on the show. If there's time. Yeah, we'll try to fit you in.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, everybody, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Remember when you first learned about the birds and the bees? Want to learn more about the birds and the bees and the berries, urban agriculture, delicious homegrown food, solar energy, and much more? Check out the Society Promoting Environmental Conservation. Come to one of our workshops, join our solar panel tour, or go to our website, www.spec.bc.ca, for more information.
So we're back to Radio Free Thinker, and well, I was actually supposed to participate in that debate when we recorded it, but I was having trouble with my microphone. And really, the only thing I want to say is that race is not what people think it is. I think that's what we can take away from this discussion.
I just wanted to add in there, too, that I'm not a racist. My only point for the whole thing was a lot of research into genetic diversity is squashed because it's considered to be somehow a racist thing. And there are some genetic questions that I think could be asked.
All right. So.
Well, we're right out of time, so I will say this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying goodnight.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob reminding you that after the show at 7:30 tonight at the Railway Club, we have the Skeptics in the Pub. Please show up and say hi.
Okay.
Okay, and I'm just going to close off with a quote from the anti-copyright. It says, this brainstorming has been halted to contact our lawyers.
Oh, well
good
said.
Night, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to big pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so big pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.